have to test it and see that it's working. Okay. Today is November 15th. November 15th, 1995. And that's Karen Brewster speaking with Eugene Brower in his home in Barrow. And when he talked to his, don't laugh at me. Today is very officially, no. I want to talk to you about your dad.
Okay.
So tell me about your dad.
In what context you talk about my father? From the earliest days I knew him, or?
Well, I guess to start with it, when you talk about him to other people, to your kids, or your grandkids who didn't know him, what do you tell them about him?
About the lifestyle we first had. You know, growing up with my father, my grandmother, up in the Inaroon River, what do you call it, Kuwaruk, living in a sod house. And there were four families living on the river. And my dad's family, Arnold Brower Sr.'s family, and two elderly couples that lived, one across the river and one on a riverbend. Ida and Matthew Haleyau that lived across the river. And Kippy and his wife, Kirik, that lived over in the riverbend, were the four families that lived together. And I tell about the kids how we used to live with the live out fishing off the river, living off the game. And how my dad used to make a run into town and selling the fish at the store, the Brower store, and coming back with some groceries that were needed. A real Eskimo way of life that we'll never go back to.
What about some of the lessons or things your dad may have taught you?
Well, as my dad taught me, were learning how to reach the snowdrift. And you're traveling away from Barrow, which way the wind has blown before you went out, and observe the snowdrift pattern. So you can find your way back, should the wind pick up again, start blowing, or you get a white out. Or you see the stars, the moon, how to read the moon, when it's got that glow around it, whether there's a storm coming or not. Which way the handle the big tipper goes, turns, during the nighttime hours, and the morning star, where it comes up, where it shows up. And that's what I think some of the things they had taught me.
Okay. One of the reasons I'm doing these kind of interviews is, I mean, I told you before, but I'm now doing it on the tape, is because I only knew your dad briefly, and can't say that I knew him because of that, and I only knew him in him telling me certain things, and trying to put all of what he said together into a story about him and his life.
Hi!
Hi! We're on tape.
Oh, hi. Good to see you.
You were good
last week.
Okay.
Some of the things that he used to do when we were growing was he used to run a trap line. Support the family running a trap line. He had three different lakes, three different routes that he did with the trap line when he set out the traps. And at times he used to make one run that would produce 20, 30 foxes. And the one out of the lake, he checked the other way, every third day would be producing maybe 3, 4, depending on where the foxes were at the time. But I've seen him haul up to almost 60 foxes.
In one day?
In one day, in making a run. He had well over 200 traps that he had spread out. He'd take off about 6 in the morning. He wouldn't be back till about 7, 8, or 9 o'clock in the evening. And he'd just take off with his coma stove and maybe his 1-quart thermos bottle and some food, a little bit of food, and he'd be gone all day. Then after he settled down and has dinner, he starts skinning them and stretching them. And he might be, I've watched him go up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 foxes in the evening. Skinning. He was quick. And that's how he supported us when we were growing up. He had a job at Narl, being a carpenter, working for the Naval Arctic Contractors, the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory, ITT, Vinel, Vico, and working at this BIA schools also.
Oh, he did?
He used to be the janitor in the early days.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's running the boiler system at the school. But he settled down working for the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory, and he worked at Hale retired as a master carpenter.
And when did he retire?
70 what? I don't know the exact date, but it was mid-70s. I mean, he worked about 25 years for the Navy.
Was it when the Navy was taken, I mean, when the Navy pulled out?
The Navy pulled out, he retired. Then he used to take his caribou hunting in the summertime, going to different places up the coastline. We went up to Alapak River, where he grew up with reindeer herds up there, where they used to have a reindeer herd. Maybe down through the chip. You could go from river to river without going out to the inlet. You go through a lake, through a little creek, and into the, like from Alapak. From the Alakta River to Tiparuk River on the east side.
Yeah.
And then go back across and look for caribou.
And all by boat?
All by boat. In summertime.
Do you remember as a kid going in a boat being pulled by dogs?
Oh yes, the skin boat. Days we used to come from Inuru, going down the river, all the way across the coastline to what is known as Admiralty Bay, down through the Allison Lagoon into Picnic, we call the shooting station Picnic, Portage over, and come into Barrow. Those took time, but I remember those days we used to have the dogs pull the boat. And sometimes we had to cross, he put a little sailboat, sail across some of the inlets.
So put the dogs in the boat?
Yes.
Must have been a full load.
Full load, but it waited on certain days. There was no rush back then. Like it is now, we weren't run by the clock. We were controlled by the wind and the weather. And after we moved here to Barrow, in the summertime, we used to go down the coastline, go camp down during the summer months. We used to hunt bear to seal, caribou, fish off the ocean, dry them and hang them and get their winter supply.
So just camp on the beach?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun.
So you spent time up on the Mead?
I've spent time on the Inaru River, the Mead River, and we're caribou hunting in summertime. The Tipaaruk River, the Chip River, or the Ikpikpuk, or the small Ikpikpuk, and the Aloktuk River. And we weren't doing that, and before we really started hunting on the east side, we used to go down the coastline in for a breakup, spring breakup, the ice breakup, and camp down the coastline. We were about 16 or 17 miles down the coastline from Barrow. And we just two families in that campsite. And there used to be a whole bunch of families that used to camp down by the Skull Cliff area where Eddie Hobson, Don Nusanginya, Eben Hobson's families were camping down there. So that's how we grew up. We had to start going to school and we moved to Barrow.
So when was that?
1950 what? I don't know what year, 1950, so we moved to Barrow. Started going to school. I know Charlie was a small boy.
So can I ask you when you were born?
48. Yeah, I didn't know how old I was, Turkey.
I don't know. I never knew how old you were. Now I have to add.
I'm 47.
You're young.
Okay.
So, well, it's kind of the... One of the things for this project is trying to know, I mean, there is a lot of information on those tapes, so how do I know what to include and not what and what to leave out? And
the stories I might be telling about this, when he's like when he was surveyor for the Navy, Seabees, back in the 40s, or I should say the 20s and the 30s. 40s or 30s? 30s? 40s. 30s, 30s and 40s. Yeah, and he used to be out with the CB surveying the North Slope. And what he surveyed has been from a demarcation point to the east, in between, all the way down to a Cape Thompson area. And when he says he walked into Arctic Village, Fort Yukon, those that he has done. And the making of Umiut camp up there. So there's a lot of historical places he's been at, or places he's been at that a lot of us haven't been at. He's very fortunate. We've only touched some of the areas he's been at by traveling in the wintertime. To the places he's told us that where he's been at, and what to look for, and there. So the different areas he traveled to, we know it's true.
So they that survey they actually walked.
They walked the country, and if they had a. If they had, what do you call it? The aircraft come in with a mail run. Sometimes they would haul it and hop on that plane and go to Fairbanks or to Barrow. And on one of his quick excursions to Barrow, he got married. And left mom hanging. He had to go right back to work.
But they must have. Did they plan to get married anyway, or?
Well, they've been, I don't know, he was chasing, she was chasing him or he was chasing her, I don't know which one, but in one of his trips he proposed and they got married, and there soon after he went back on the survey crew. And I don't know how long he's been, he's gone for a number of months before he came back and finally seen her again. Tough on whom? I don't know. Anyway, it wasn't on him.
Was it?
He left the country.
I'm making hot tea.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess from the woman's perspective, it must have been tough.
Oh, yeah. I don't think Mom ever recovered from that. I don't know what he treated her to. What she treated him. You see, I always made reference to that when she got mad at him.
Oh, really? But you see, I never knew your mom.
Mom was a very strong-willed woman. But back in the 70s, after when Charlotte and I got married, he said, "Son, you're settling down. How about just putting away?" He had his own whaling crew back when he was a young man.
Mm-hmm.
He had a bunch of old men that he had were whaling for him. He had his own crew when he was 16. And when his father passed away, his gear got sold to Haralita. He tried buying him back, but his brother couldn't sell it to him. And he whaled with different whaling crews here for a while, but back in 71 or 72, he said, he said, "Yeah, let's put a crew together." So we did.
How did you do that?
Well, inherited the gear from inherited the gear from Steve Hobson, Sr., who was my grandpa from my mother's side when he was relocating over to Noisette. He gave my dad his gear, whaling gear. Yeah, we built the first skin boat and got the other stuff together and went out and went whaling. We didn't catch a whale that year, that season, but the following year we got a whale. And it's been on a pretty successful rate that we've been catching whales over the years. There was a spell for about two or three years we didn't catch nothing. But almost every year we've been fortunate enough to receive a whale.
He taught you about
whaling? Mm-hmm. I first went whaling with a man by the name of Luther Levitt. Luther and Cora came over to my parents' house and wanted to know if he could teach me the art of whaling. So my first years of as a little boy was through Luther Levitt. And as I got older, I went whaling with Arnold Brower Sr., Wyman Pennycue. And back to Luther Levitt. And through the different steps of becoming promoted to different levels in the whaling crew.
So there are different levels?
Yes. You got the first level is the one that just help you break trail and don't really go out anywhere but to help around the house and get a little bit better shear. And then you get the crew that goes out safe with you that help push it over, like a crew share. And until you can get to a boat to the status where you earn enough where you can go be part of the crew that paddles the boat, the skin boat, going to a whale or chasing a whale that's been wounded. Until it is caught or gets away from you. Dad first put the crew out. He had Herbert Levitt on the crew, and he had Wesley Aiken, myself, and Charlie, my brother, and a couple of the people. It's a small crew, but it has grown over the years. It's a good sized crew now. We
have one of the biggest crews now?
We have one of the biggest crews in town. You being part of it should know that
it
is.
I know. I didn't know it was one of the biggest. That's kind of what it seems like it.
It is the biggest crew.
It seems really big.
Crew and crew members, yes. It's very noticeable during Nalakatak.
I noticed like half the circle was all up through.
Seems like the more successful you are, the bigger crew is, but also by the same token, just within the family, our sons are growing.
Yeah.
My brothers and their sons. And a couple of my cousins. Zachariah, he'll never get married. He'll be a bachelor for the rest of his life. He talks about getting married, but he hasn't found the right woman yet. Hint, hint. Oh, the blush is telling the story.
You should have seen me yesterday. I was with friends and something happened and I turned bright red. I was trying so hard not to turn red. And they're like, oh, there goes the forehead.
Seen Zachariah, huh?
No, somebody else. I'm trying to think some of the...
But my father has been very successful as a whaling captain. He's a well-respected whaler in this community. And, matter of fact, he helped Dr. Albert get situated when Dr. Albert first started working for the borough as a scientist on the study of the bowhead. He made a lot of office until my father spoke up to the group and told him, hey, help this man out, he's going to be here to help you, help us out. And after that, the whalers, there's some somewhat vocal, reluctantly, opened their doors to Dr. Albert, and now Dr. Albert is a well-known bowhead scientist.
So do you know why your dad decided it was something to let this guy do it?
Well, I think my father had a talk with him, and from the way Dr. Albert presented himself to my father believed him. He was here just for a short duration. He wasn't going to be here just for a short stay. He's going to be here for a long time. And now he's about in the 17th year up here. And for a man to leave, he's a prestigious position back in a major university back east. That would be quite an undertaking.
But do you think your dad saw... I mean, it seemed, from my knowing him and talking to him, he understood a lot about whales and the importance of the science.
Yes. I think because of the attack we had from IWC, and having been exposed to scientists before and having worked with them over the years, that the science was the way out to prove to the world that the whales were not on a decline. And based on his own personal knowledge and observation, he knew they were on an upswing. But he knew that people outside wouldn't believe us just because we were saying it. And he needed people with the degrees or the scientists to say what we've been saying all along.
That's too bad that it had to be that way.
He saw it before we did. We were too busy rabble rousing, and he was using science on science.
What?
He was using science on science, or science against science. What are you saying? He was using what the scientists were saying, well, they were on a decline. You're using the other scientists to say, no, they're on a rise. Using their degrees against each other. Yes, he knew that they wouldn't believe us. The people outside in the scientific arena wouldn't believe them. The native people were just blowing hot smoke.
What did your dad do with this? You said he's a carpenter at Narl, but he also worked with the animals and the scientists a lot, right?
Yes. He was a guide for different researchers that came over to do research work in different parts of the North Slope. He knew the animals and the way they behaved, and been exposed to them as a hunter, having hunted them. He took people from Tokyo, from all over the world that come up. He was their guide and mentor. Matter of fact, one Japanese couple, young couple that were up here, when they went back home, their firstborn son is called Kupa. And he's got a full-size picture of himself at one of the major universities back in Japan.
Really? Wow. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. A full-size picture of my father.
Do you know where?
He's at the university one time. But there used to be a lot of Arctic researchers coming out of the University of Tokyo. Mm-hmm. You get to know a lot of them from there. They had researchers from UAF and USC, McGill University. They worked with different researchers from those major universities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I met one of them. Frank Petelka.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him about your dad. I don't really remember what he said, but a little bit, he felt like he didn't give the Yupik people enough credit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he told me one story about being out someplace and being rescued, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Where were we? Oh.
Where were we?
Rescuing people.
Rescuing people. Well, he's rescued a few people in his lifetime, whether they're researchers or local people that got lost there. You guys have. You could try to think how that person would think if they got lost. And he had a pretty good success rate when he went on a rescue mission. And he found his own trapping partner that got lost up there, that got sidetracked, Antonio Weber. I don't know if you've heard the story about him.
No, I don't think so.
Back in the early 70s, I'm sure the mid-70s, they were trapping, and they went out to check their trap line day before Christmas. Dad came home. Antonio didn't come home. Word about him. Charlotte and I came home from a movie. Said, we got to go look for Antonio. Then we went looking for him. We went out searching. And then we came back, got Kenny Tuvok involved with a weasel and some gas and some other local people. And we were looking for him. And we finally caught up with Antonio down about 30 miles below Barrow. He was chasing my father. He was chasing a light. That moves just like a snow machine, but you get over the bluff, you see it, and you go in the valley, and you come back up, it's gone. It'd be a different location.
So what was it?
We never knew what he was chasing. But we found to find Antonio Weber, based on the direction my father said he was going to be taken.
And where did he start? Where was their trap line?
East of Barrow.
So no one ever figured out what the light was?
Nope. They've got stories about the shaman and spirit being that have come up over the years of learning. They know how to go with their drive with a snow machine now.
Oh,
they
yeah.
used to go with their, they used to go with a dog team before carrying a lantern. But they get different stories about those old shaman that their spirits linger on up here. Well, that's one of the old stories of the shaman that now drives a snow machine.
Well, I've never heard the one about them driving dog team.
You've heard about the one driving a snow machine?
No, I haven't heard that particular. I mean, I've heard little bits about shamans and being able to go to other places. But I haven't heard one about traveling with a light.
Well, you haven't heard all the stories up here.
I know. Well, go ahead, tell me.
Well, you got that one portion of what you're looking at about my father. You can tell all kinds of stories. But it won't be about my father.
Well, that's okay.
Well, over the years, I talked about my father, he started going into carving. And he got to be quite a carver. His first pieces of work were some stuff to look at. Weren't really good to look at, but with time, he refined his technique of carving and making baling boats. And these baling boots got to be quite a sale item for him that people constantly wanted to buy. And some of the carvings he did. So he gets to be well known as an artist. Eskimo artist.
So, did he only start to do that kind of stuff in his later years?
In his later years, yes. He'd be, in his maybe late 40s or early 50s, he started carving. Then we do it to pass time in the evenings. He's got to be quite renowned in that area. And the one that really surprised me was when I don't know what year it was, but him and Kenny Divock got recognized by that Sigma Psi, the scientific group, giving him awards as their contribution to the scientific world. So that's quite a surprise to us when he got that award.
Oh, yeah. What did he think about it?
They were there. They needed help, and I helped. He never thought about getting an award or receiving anything. He just did what he knew and passed it on. One thing he always said to me was that when you come across a hotshot Arctic scientist, ask him about the time he spent with that little old man or that little old lady or that man that took him out. And made him the Arctic expert. Did that scientist ever take time to thank him and acknowledge him for the knowledge he has gained about the Arctic through the local people? The real professors, the ones without the degrees, that taught him. And he said that's the quickest way to get those people's attention. I've never seen my father really get mad at anything. One of the stories I could tell about him is that when they were doing the land claims issue, he took Lester Suvlu, Billy Nearcock, Stanley Brower. Brought a whole bunch of maps over to my parents' house. And they told him, what would you say the boundaries of the Arctic slope were? And without hesitation, he went from demarcation point, following the foothills, all the way down by below Point Hope. And he told him, this is the North Slope, this is the Inupiaq country. And those people have never acknowledged him. So called the native leaders of the Arctic Slope. They try to take a lot of comfort and say, this is Arctic Slope country. And my father was the one that made the boundary. He told him, this is what you fight for. Below that, there's Indian country.
And that was something that made him mad that he was never
thanked. Yeah, he was never acknowledged because the people tried to take so much credit for that, and because of his vast knowledge of the Arctic, mm-hmm. having been with the survey crew, that these people weren't even born here when he walked this country, and he knew where these sites they're talking about are, based from his, from the information they got from him. Mm-hmm. And they make themselves the author, or the ones that know the country, after first talking to him and getting information from him. That's one thing that he regrets for not being recognized. That's the man behind the scenes that put, back then it was Arctic Slope Native Association.
It's interesting just listening that the scientists acknowledged him finally,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of like, oh well, that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And what he really wanted was acknowledgement
from his own people. That the Arctic Slope Association was not Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Was made in his own house when he set the boundaries for Egypt and the winter. Went to Washington, D.C. That he helped make what Arctic Slope enjoys now. And that's how the boundary he made got to be the boundaries of the North Slope Borough.
I remember him sort of, I think he mentioned it, but I don't think we really ever talked about it a lot. I don't remember.
No, they don't say a whole lot about it. But I do know that the boundary of the North Slope Borough is a boundary he made for Arctic Slope Native Association, mm-hmm. back in the 60s.
Yeah, I know. I sort of remember him mentioning it, that he had done that, but I don't
really
talk about it.
Yeah, without them they would have had the Arctic Slope real small, or the Arctic Slope, or the border boundary would have been a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, your dad never seemed to be real involved in the front politics.
No, he was never in the limelight. He just stayed behind. He let the talker do the talking. But he's hoping that at least one of them would acknowledge him. Okay, the information came from him.
Mm-hmm. He just didn't like to be in the light. I mean, for any other of the rest, I mean, after that, or before that, he was never into the politics.
No. The only politics he got involved with is Busey.
Oh, yeah?
He's Busey director.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. He served very early years at Barry Utilities. They got a picture of him hanging in their wall over there. They got all the board directors over at Busey in their boardroom that are hanging in.
Oh, and they've been in their boardroom.
You have to go to the board and see it, and you take the pictures of all these different people. A lot of them have gone now.
Yeah.
In the early years, back in the '60s.
I remember you telling me once when you sort of were talking about it with his carving, and when he first, you remember when he first started making baleen boats and how he came up with that? I mean, he had a real specific system that I've never seen anybody else make baleen boats, so I don't know if that's how they all do it.
No, each one's got his own pattern, and he learned how to break a baleen in half, or split a baleen in half to make the baleen boat with.
Mm-hmm.
He refined that and also learned how to use different things to make the boat look like a sailboat.
Mm-hmm.
Like using colored the colored portion of the baleen. Then using maybe for the front sail part of the baleen from a dead gray whale. The gray whale have a short baleen or white. And they get the ripples in them. Where baleen is almost smooth. I think he first started to do it when a man by the name Bill O'Shea, who was working for Crawley Maritime, he's come up every summer when the barges come up,
mm-hmm.
asked him to make a dock sled with so many docks pulling it. I remember that person when he first started doing that. He had a hard time making the docks the way the docks were supposed to look. Out of wood and put him on a board.
So he made him out of wood?
Mm-hmm. And later on, after he patterned it down, he made him out of baleen, out of ivory.
Well, that must have been pretty.
Quite a sight, yes. He had about 10 or 12 dogs pulling that sled with a caribou jaw sled.
So with his boats and all those refining, splitting and cutting the pieces, he just was creative and taught himself and figured
mm-hmm.
out new ways to do it?
Yes, he did that himself. I'm not a carver. I don't have the patience to do that stuff. The only one that's patient with the family is Ronald. And I think he's slowly picking up that my dad talked to him, trying to remember what my dad said. When he's making the baleen boats, he's now getting close to, almost getting close to the way, making the way my father did.
Oh, yeah?
But over the years, my dad was most happy when he was out hunting. I mean, that took him hunting. In his later years, he wanted to go camping or go hunting. That's when he was most happiest. That's what he liked to do. And he said, you don't hunt for yourself, you hunt for the community. You hunt for the old people that can't hunt anymore. Bring him the choice parts of the animal. And the animal will come back to you tenfold. And when I look over the years of the whales that we have received, 80% of those whales that we caught have been ingratos. which is quite amazing.
Why do you think that is?
Maybe it's because the whales are paying us back for what he has done for the elders, the widowers within his community, by bringing him choice parts of the animals at different times of the year over to their houses. Out of the blue, he walked in to go over and visit some old folks with carrying some choice muktuk or choice meat of an animal that would be a delicacy and give it to him. And we did that to one old man, Sakyaga. He took that aside and told him for you taking care of me and my wife all these years, and we can't hunt no more. The whales that you catch are going to be right from the shore. You don't have to chase them. You will strike them. Your boat will strike those whales right from the shore fast ice. And that's where most of our whales have been taken. It's from right from the shore fast ice.
I know. I think your dad's probably. I didn't know anything about whaling before I came here. I think it was what he told me. I never realized you could get them from the shore fast ice.
Mm-hmm.
And we gotta go out in the boat.
Nope. That's the last one he struck right there by himself.
Oh, in that picture?
May 27th. What?